Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. And we're going to slow down now, way down, talk about slow medicine. You've heard about the slow food movement, born almost 30 years ago in Italy, a response to the arrival of the country's first McDonald's and an antidote to industrialized processed foods.
Well, slow medicine is born of a similar idea, a response to industrialized, hyper-technological, and often unnecessary medical care. It embraces getting to know your patients instead of just treating them, and it means placing slow observation over quick intervention.
That's how Dr. Peter Cohen envisions it. He's a primary care doctor at Cambridge Health Alliance and a big proponent of slow medicine. He's helped spark a nationwide conversation among doctors about its merits. And he joins us now in the studio. And Peter Cohen, great to have you. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Anthony, thanks for having me.
So I think we sort of, Lisa and I kind of explained it in broad terms, but I want to hear it from you. What is slow medicine beyond the sort of quick way we just described it?
Sure. Well, I'd like to think about that we borrow three main principles from the slow food movement. One is to really get to know, in the case of food, your food. If you're not growing it yourself, get to know your butchers, the farmer, your baker. Similarly, of course, it's knowing your patient and individualizing your treatment for that individual patient. The second major theme is that the latest fad, the latest gizmo, is not necessarily the healthiest or the best approach. And third is to appreciate slowing down. Now, with the slowing down part, I do need to clarify a bit. Personally, in clinic, I need to move quite fast.
Right. You've got to see a lot of patients in the course of a day.
I only have 20 minutes per patient.
Right. Yeah. So how do you slow down with that?
So what we're talking about slowing down, and some people in the slow medicine movement actually are able, because of where they practice, to take a lot of time with patients. But we don't have that luxury, and most primary care docs don't. So the slowing down has to do with slowly integrating the advances in medical care with what we do. Mm. And it also means slowing down and not rushing diagnostic testing or studies or treatment. So if I see a patient and we're not sure what's going on, we would first ask ourselves, why not see them back in a week or two? Why not let time help us declare the diagnosis or sort out the diagnosis?
Maybe one of the things that happens, though, in sort of the non-expert person's idea of the way you guys do your work is sort of presented by TV, where it's almost like, you know, doctors make these quick diagnoses and just in the nick of time. And if not for that incredible diagnosis that that doctor made, the patient would have been dead. You know what I mean?
Right, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that there's a small percentage of medical practice that's like that,
right,
like in the TV dramas, where you have to act within moments. But truth be told, when doctors have to act that fast, we actually are usually basing it on structured checklists and protocols. Because even the best clinician cannot, within a minute or two, make a sophisticated diagnosis.
Yeah.
So in those situations, like in a car trauma, we just have to go through our checklists or algorithms and get it right.
Right, right. I see. Interesting. Well, listen, I want to invite our listeners into this conversation. We're going to be talking a lot more with Dr. Peter Cohen about this whole idea of slow medicine. But from what you've heard so far, what do you make of this idea, listeners, of slow medicine? Have you experienced this type of treatment from your doctor? Do you feel that your treatment is anything but slow? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. We want to hear from you about slow medicine. What questions do you have for Dr. Peter Cohen? So, Peter, give us a real-life example, maybe, of medical care that you have been involved with that's a nice example of what you're talking about. Maybe a real case, a real patient.
Sure. So, just yesterday, for example, in clinic, let's take two sides of the story. One is in a situation where I wish we had been able to approach it differently. A 67-year-old gentleman whom I care for had 5 months of neck pain. And he ended up in an outside emergency room. And there, despite nothing alarming about his symptoms and nothing but pain that seemed to be musculoskeletal, in other words, when he turned, it was aching him, they performed a CAT scan of his neck this CAT scan, though, of his neck, as is traditionally done, picked off the top of his lungs as well. Mm-hmm. And in the top of their lungs, his lungs, there was a bit of scarring. So the question by for the radiologist, or the report by the radiologist, was to make sure we did a full CAT scan of his lungs later on in follow-up. So I was seeing him in follow-up. And we were already we're heading down this route of the CT scan was probably unnecessary. And now I was in the position, I needed to order a CAT scan to follow up because of this, the escalating process that can happen when we start doing unnecessary tests. So that's an example of where I wish we had managed it a little more conservatively or a little slowly.
And is the concern there that, I mean, you were just, the CAT scan was unnecessary. So you're just putting this patient through unnecessary inconvenience and discomfort, essentially.
Well, it can get a lot more complicated than that because the CAT scan was excessive radiation, which by itself would not be terrible, one CAT scan. But then if you add that then to the radiation of the lung CAT scan that's now going to be required in follow-up, and then the possibility, what if a little smudge is seen on the lung CAT scan and the radiologist recommends that he see a cardiothoracic surgeon to have that biopsied or removed? Well, there's probably a good chance that even if it were to be removed, if something were just found incidentally on a CAT scan, that when it's removed, it's actually a benign process, a little scar or something. Mm-hmm. Much less likely that we're going to be saving him from cancer, from dying from lung cancer. So it's this snowballing effect of how diagnostic studies lead to other diagnostic studies that can lead to unnecessary treatment and intervention.
Hmm. So this idea of slowing things down enough so that you can spend more time getting to know your patient, I mean, is one of the keys here. It sounds like you're sort of going back to a more traditional idea of medicine. Is that fair?
Absolutely. Yeah. So we, just like the slow food movement, we're not reinventing food and we're not reinventing the practice of medicine. We're simply getting back to the roots of medical practice, spending our time carefully discussing the story, the interview with the patient, carefully examining the patient, and letting that guide all future decisions. In addition, of course, the patient's individual values and interests in pursuing the problem.
So does this get to the idea that sometimes the best thing that a doctor can do for a patient is just to, I don't know, almost assure him or her that things are okay?
I think that is one of the most important roles that we have that in primary care, certainly. The idea is that so many patients come to us with concerns that the biggest harm is unnecessarily intervening or unnecessarily treating. If we can spend time talking to the patient, examining them meticulously, and then letting them know that we are not worried right now about serious illness, but we're going to follow with you. We care about you and we want to know if symptoms change. It's that it has to be combined with a caring and follow-up, because if you're in a situation where you can't see someone in the future, you can't guarantee follow-up care, and you don't express personal interest in the patient, you're not going to make much progress in reassuring them.
Mm. Let's get some listeners into this conversation. And again, we're talking to Dr. Peter Cohen. He's a primary care doctor at Cambridge Health Alliance, and he's sparked a nationwide conversation among doctors about slow medicine. You've heard about the slow food movement. This is the slow medicine movement. What do you think? What do you hear? What questions do you have? 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Meredith, who's calling from Brookline. Hi, Meredith. You're on the air.
Hi. I just had a question for Dr. Cohen. First of all, I totally agree with the slowing down of care, et cetera. And I've had the same primary care physician for 10 years, and I think he's fantastic. But I heard a lot about the clinical perspective, whereas, you know, if somebody goes to the doctor with a sinus infection, I don't know how much they're going to want to be told to come back in a week, because taking time off from work and their busy schedules sometimes just doesn't warrant that.
All right, Meredith, thanks for that question. Speak to that issue, the sinus infection. I want relief now.
Yes, that's a very common discussion I have with my patients. And sinus infections are a great example, actually, because the great majority of sinus infections, especially early on in the first few days, are usually due to viruses and don't require antibiotics. So it's a great opportunity to slow down and to encourage to explain that many of these infections will improve with having interventions that will clean out the sinuses. So absolutely, as Meredith points out, we need to have different approaches than just coming and being seen again in clinic in a week. Absolutely. So two options with the sinus infections. One is delayed prescription. So once patients understand that taking antibiotics now is unnecessary, you can often get buy-in. We can often get buy-in to give a prescription now and wait. If you're still ill or symptoms worsen, then pick up the prescription. If not, don't use it. And another possibility is to check in over the phone. And of course, we work in teams, so it might not be myself, but it might be our nurse on the team who's calling to check in a week later. And if symptoms persist at that time, prescribing antibiotics.
All right. Meredith, thanks so much for that call. Let's go to Christine, who's calling from Acton. Christine, you're on the air.
Hi. I just had a story about my dad and what I think might qualify as slow medicine, slow intervention, and where it kind of went awry. And I just wanted to see if, maybe the doctor thought that this was, a good example of it and what could have been prevented. My dad, a couple of years back, presented with a stroke, was taken to the hospital, was unconscious, and then came to and felt a lot better. And that evening, they basically just kept him at the hospital and monitored him, but they didn't really do any diagnostic work or treat him with anything. They didn't give him any, medicine or anything. And then shortly thereafter, the next morning, around 7 in the morning, he had an acute heart attack and coded for 22 minutes. And they finally revived him. He was in a coma for a few weeks and then had severe brain trauma after that and had, physical therapy therapy for his brain for the next year or so. And it just seems like in a case like that, slow medicine might actually cause more harm than, an aggressive treatment.
Well, Christine, thanks for calling in, and I'm sorry to hear about your father. Peter Cohen, what do you think?
Christine, first off, I'm so sorry about that tragic story. And you raise an excellent point. We absolutely are not advocating for just simply not intervening or just sitting around and doing nothing. We're actually talking about using the best evidence available. So a perfect example of this comes up with stroke treatment. Just this week, there's new data to suggest that if someone has a stroke where a clot gets up to the brain, that there is technology that can reach in, new technology in terms of the actual reaching tool can reach in and pull out that clot, that for the first time we're seeing evidence that that can work in addition to giving very powerful blood thinners. So this is a great example where though we mentioned slow medicine, we sometimes are very fast adapters once the evidence becomes clear that that will improve outcomes.
Interesting. Christine, thanks so much for that call. I wanted to ask you about the idea of avoiding fads in medicine, as you call them. Give us an example of that.
Well, one of the best is one that I was completely fooled by or taken into, and that was hormone replacement therapy. When I was in medical school in the late 1990s, my Yale professors told me that almost every single woman after menopause should be started on hormone replacement therapy. It made perfect sense. When women were young and healthy with these hormones on board, they didn't run into problems like heart disease. But after menopause, without the hormones, they did. Well, I took that advice and I aggressively recommended hormone replacement therapy to all my patients and family members who had passed menopause. And it was really an eye-opener the year after I graduated from residency when the Women's Health Initiative was published, in which it defined a huge study of tens of thousands of women, in which it definitively showed that not only was hormone replacement therapy associated with risks we already knew, like breast cancer and increased clots, but also increased the risk of what we were trying to prevent, heart disease, and strokes. And I was even further disheartened years later to learn through meticulous investigative reporting that some of the studies I had read back in residency had actually been ghostwritten by the company Wyeth selling hormone replacement therapy. So even the research, it wasn't just my medical school professors, but it was also the academic literature, had been infiltrated by misinformation. Mm-hmm. And that really made me question many of the paradigms that we were currently practicing.
I'd love to ask you about sort of the caution that you raise about unnecessary testing. And just give you a case in point that came up actually as we were talking about this segment yesterday in the staff and among my staff. And so the federal guidelines recommends breast cancer screening every 2 years for women between the ages of 50 and 74. But we were having a conversation about this, and one of our colleagues made the point that she was diagnosed with breast cancer and treated successfully in her 40s. So she feels that early testing was critical, even if it might not be supported by, you know, the statistics. So what do you say to that case of like, yeah, don't overdo it with the testing because statistically it's, you know, it suggests that you're probably not going to get much benefit, but even if it's 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 10,000, if you're that person who gets saved by, you know, early and aggressive testing, how do you caution against too much testing?
Well, that's just a great question. And fundamentally, let's take a step back and think about screening for first place. So this is a situation where we're screening for breast cancer. And what screening means is that we take a person who's completely healthy. They came to you because they're great and they just want to live longer and healthier. And then we are intervening as physicians. And we're saying, do this study or do that study. You'll live longer, presumably, or healthier.
Right.
So the bar should be pretty high to suggest something to a healthy person in order to try to improve their health. And in the case of breast cancer, that's a great example. So let's look at mammography screening for women in their 40s. So it does decrease a woman's risk of dying from breast cancer, but it does so for one woman out of 1,000 screened. The problem is that the majority of women who are screened get unnecessary treatments. Mm-hmm. About half of the women screened over a 10-year period will have unnecessary false alarms. These might lead to biopsies and sometimes even diagnoses of cancer that never needed to be treated in the first place. So looked at it a different way, when I'm talking to my patients who are 40 years old and wondering about screening mammography, I explain that on average, this intervention will lead to more harm, more likelihood of unnecessary biopsies or treatment than it will for benefit. Now, we should look at it a different way, though, of course, from a patient's perspective, it's completely different, who has already been diagnosed with breast cancer through mammography screening. In that case, everyone who has experienced that will certainly think, and there's no reason not to, that mammography saved their lives. However, in reality, the majority of those women, their lives were not saved by the mammogram. Mm-hmm. The saved life is the rare exception. The more common scenario, and this again is women in their 40s who are screened, is that either the cancer would declare itself maybe 6 months or 12 months later by finding a lump or some pain and be treated, and the woman would do just as well. Another possibility is that small breast cancers could linger for 10, 20 years and never cause problems. And we're picking up on those almost silent breast cancers now because we're doing so much mammography screening. Mm. So if you have breast cancer detected through mammography, especially in your 40s, the chance that the mammogram saved your life is still relatively small.
Mm-hmm. We only have about a minute left, and I want to at least get one more question in. So let me ask you this, and I'm just curious how you can teach slow medicine to new doctors in this environment that seems to value everything you're talking about sort of needing to be not devalued, but valued less is what I'm trying to say. How do you teach this, and what kind of success do you think young doctors are having in embracing this idea of slow medicine?
Well, I would turn back to what a dean of Harvard Medical School in the 1940s, Sidney Burwell, famously said, which was that he said to the fourth years, you're graduating now, but the problem is 50% of what we've taught you is wrong. But what's even more concerning than that, I don't even know which 50% it is. So my students tell me that the slow medicine approach is like trying every day to try to figure out what is that 50% that we got wrong and getting it right tomorrow.
Interesting. Really interesting. Dr. Peter Cohen is a primary care doctor at Cambridge Health Alliance. We've been talking about the slow medicine movement. There's a lot more information at radioboston.org. You can go there, leave a comment. Listeners, I'm sorry for those of you that we didn't get to. But Dr. Peter Cohen, thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.
And listeners, stay with us. Coming up, we'll take a look back at the best tech gadgets of 2014. I'm Anthony Brooks with Lisa Mullins. This is Radio Boston.